Hello and welcome to Matt's Trucking Great Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Ireland. Just before we get started today, I'd just like to say a quick thank you to all of the regular sponsors, Creasy's Drainage, QD UK, GoFetch, all the companies that have supported by sponsoring an individual episode, everybody who's donated via Buy Me A Coffee and Patreon. It all really does help with the running of it. And if you'd like to consider a donation, it would be really much appreciated. Also, a big thanks to Todd, the editor, but that's enough of all the thank yous for now, I think. So I'm going to introduce today's guest. Today, it's a little anniversary as well, which is nice. It's my good friend, Pip Dunn. Pip, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm very good, mate. I'm very good. So today is the 30th anniversary of you becoming what?
Today is the 30th anniversary of me becoming a professional journalist.
Good Lord.
It is, particularly as it's something I'd never actually intended on doing. I just stumbled into it. And then 30 yeah. years ago, I started, and we're still going.
Excellent. So how do we get to this point in time? Because you obviously have an interest in trucks. Where did that begin from?
Well, the interest in trucks started when I was about 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. We were living in Birmingham, and my dad was relocating offices to Warwick. And obviously, we needed to move house. So my dad was looking at houses in Kenilworth, Warwick, Leamington, surrounding area. And we're going back to 1978 here. Mm-hmm. So I dare say he got phone calls at work from estate agents saying, we've got this property, do you want to go and see it? And he'd get home from work, we'd be home from school, he'd bundle me and my brother and my sister and obviously my mum into the Ford Cortina with the pie chart rear light setup.
And what a machine.
And we would pootle off down to Warwickshire. And that was basically Junction 6, Spaghetti Junction 6, down to Junction 4, and then off through Borsall Common towards Kenilworth or Warwick or Leamington. And we'd go and see a house. And then obviously my parents drew up a short list of what they wanted from houses and this sort of thing. And we plumped on a house in the town of Kenilworth, which is halfway between Coventry and Leamington.
Yeah.
Now, during those journeys, even though they were probably only about 35 minutes long, they seemed to last an eternity. I just started watching the lorries on the road, which would have back then in 78 would have been ERS and Fodens and Leylands and Bedfords and DAFs and Scanias and Volvos and everything. And when we plumped on the house in Kenilworth, obviously I went to a new school. I started at new school and there was a kid in, he was actually in the year below me. We moved there in May 78, and this, so I would have just turned 9, so this lad would have been 8. And his dad operated a small haulage fleet, all Volvos,
right.
But he did Middle East and European work, mostly European work, but he did do a fair few Middle East trips as well. And he'd got an F88, an F89, which was quite rare in those days, left-hand drive with a big 12-litre engine. And then he'd got an F10 and an F12, which were pretty new. They'd only come out in 1977, yeah. So they were very new. So I got to know this kid, and I used to go up to the farm that his dad ran the haulage company out of was actually visible from my bedroom, would you believe, because our house was right on the edge of Kenilworth, looking out onto fields, and then in the distance was the farm where he kept his trucks at, and I could just about see the trucks when they were parked there. And I used to go, this lad, Dave Jackson, who I'm still friends with today, thanks to the wonders of Facebook.
What was the name of the company? Was it Jackson's or something like that?
The company was Kenilworth International Transport, KIT.
Right,
and
KIT.
Dark blue colours. Often the trailers were other companies' trailers, but they did have their own tilt trailers, 2 or 3 of those, I think. So yeah, I used to go up and play. I mean, I was only 9, so I used to play in the trucks with Dave and what have you. And his dad used to give me copies of Truck Magazine, which were I mean, I guess I was mostly looking at the pictures really. I don't think I age 9 I was really working in depth at the
break, test reports and things
like
that.
Yeah, the brake performance of a Leyland marathon or something. And
yeah.
Then my gran, in 1980, my gran started buying me Truck Magazine every month, and I'd pick it up from my local news agents and I'd read it. Well, I say cover to cover, I wouldn't read the really boring stuff, but I started to sponge up all the information about all these trucks, you know, so I knew that an F10 had a smaller engine than an F12, and that a Scania 80 series had the smaller cab, and the 110 series had the bigger cab, and what have you. Mm-hmm. And then I bought the Bible at the time, the Observer's Book of Commercial Vehicles. I think the first one I got was the 1978 edition, which I'm going to take a punt on had, it was either the Leyland T45, no, it must have been the one before that with the, I think it actually had a Peterbilt on the cover. Anyway,
yeah.
And that suddenly opened me up to all these weird and wonderful names of companies. I mean, some of the American stuff was featured quite heavily in truck, but when you start learning about Saurer from Switzerland and OAF from Austria and Steyr from Austria and all these weird and wonderful companies, you know, and then just as a kid, you'd suddenly see one of these things. You'd see a Pegaso or a Steyr, which had come over from its homeland. You'd see it at a service station. I even bizarrely saw a Steyr parked in a residential area in Kenilworth once. A little, it was a 4x2 tilt, but it was obviously a drawbar. I even managed to get a photograph of that. And so that's where my interest in trucks and lorries came about.
Right.
And sort of age 10, 11, I just wanted to be a long-distance lorry driver. I wanted a Volvo F12 and to be going off to wherever on the globe. You know, I mean, before I got into trucks, obviously I'd never heard of countries like Oman and Qatar and probably even some of the Baltic states and what have you.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of geography lesson in there as well. And the only reason I never became a truck driver back then was kind of peer pressure from my parents, particularly my mum was kind of, I think she was just thinking that truck driving was a bit of a dead-end job, which it most certainly isn't. And she kind of sort of said, oh, you need to go into engineering, you need to do maths.
Need a qualification.
Yeah, go and get a degree in engineering or something. And I kind of blindly sort of followed that for a little while. And then one day, this was in 1984, so I was 15 at this point, I suddenly saw that there was this thing that truck used to do. It was inside the back cover. It was called A Life in the Day Of, which at first I thought they'd got the wrong way around, but I saw it was actually a play on words.
Yeah.
And one of, you know, usually it was some of, not necessarily a lorry driver as such, but some of the people associated with the industry, but also maybe some of the obscure jobs or something, you know. Maybe somebody whose main job was something else, but they drove a lorry to support their job or something, you know, the guys who put out the cones on motorways, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there was this interview with this lad who was doing a degree in transport and distribution. And so I actually said to my mum, I said, well, what about this, you know? And she said, oh, yeah, that sounds good. So, but by this point, I was doing the wrong exams. And then I really kind of cocked it up by then going to do the totally the wrong A-level. So I was doing maths, physics and technology at A-level. And I wasn't enjoying them. And I wasn't understanding them. And also, at age 16, because it was a different world back then, I could go to the pubs. And, you know,
yes.
And so I was going to the pub every weekend, trying vainly to chat up girls and not getting anywhere. But I did get my first serious girlfriend, and then I did, you know, and I just wasn't interested in school. And it wasn't because I didn't want to learn. It was because I was doing the wrong subjects. And so I flunked my A-levels, a bit American word there, flunked. So I didn't do very well in my A-levels. I got one E out of the two of them.
Yeah,
and I wasn't going to get. By this time, I'd applied to go on for the transport and distribution course at Huddersfield. Well, it was Polytechnic back then, and obviously, I hadn't got the grades. There was a HND at Bolton, which we looked at, but it required you to pass all of 12 modules. And I just said to my parents, "I said I can't see me doing that. I just cannot see me doing it." So I went to resit the A levels, the two that I'd failed, but. You know, your paper over the cracks, it's exactly the same. Still didn't understand it, still didn't enjoy it, and I hated it. And midway through, a friend of mine came to me and said, oh, just so you know, I've just got a job at this warehouse in Warwick, and they're taking on staff. It's only just opened a big book warehouse called Heathcote Books, serving, in fact, I think it was actually owned by W.H. Smith, but it supplying books to all customers. So I applied for a job there, and it was meant to be a fairly tame job, just picking the orders and putting them in boxes. But within a couple of weeks, I'd managed to wangle myself into the goods inwards department, you know. And so I spent my day processing the orders off the lorries, which is great because I took my camera in, got some nice pictures while I was there. did my forklift licenses. But deep down, I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do long term. It was a great job for me at age 19, getting out of my system. I left home. My dad relocated again and moved up to Manchester. So I stayed down there and I lodged locally. And it was great, actually very good learning experiences in life, you know.
Yeah, finding a way in the world sort of thing.
It's funny, I'm teaching my daughter to drive at the moment. Well, not just me teaching her, obviously she has lessons as well. But I was telling her only the other day that I had, for my learning to drive, because I didn't actually learn to drive a car till I was 20. In fact, I was 21 when I passed. I funded all that myself, you know. I funded my first car, I funded my insurance. And she's just sitting there moaning because she's got a 12-year-old car. And I keep saying, Christ, you're doing better than I did. So anyway, as well as working in the warehouse, I had a part-time job in my local pub, which again, I did for the social side of it as much as anything else, although the money did come in useful. And it was there one night, I was working away, and some of my old college sixth form tutors came in, obviously on a social, and I got chatting to my old headmaster, and he was really nice. And he said to me, you know, oh, what are you doing? I told him, he said, you know, and he said, oh, you wanted to do transport. I said, yeah, I didn't get the grades. He said, well, look, you do know education never closes its door on you. And that phrase has stuck with me ever since. And he said, and if you want to have a chat about going back to university, my door's always open. So I thought, I'll take you up on that offer. And the following day, I went down to see him. And he was brilliant. And he rang the university up, and they'd remembered I'd applied 4 years ago. Or 3 years ago this was, and they said, look, it's a bit too late to get on this year's course,
okay,
and we'd like you to do an A-level at evening class to show that you're willing to get back into education. So that's what I did. So I managed to get onto the economics A-level at my local college, which was one night a week, I think, maybe two. I think it was just one. And we went from there. And I passed the A-level, and I got on the course. So I trotted up to Huddersfield to study transport and logistics management, and that was my plan. And maybe it was because of those days as a kid looking at all these lorries going over Europe and the Middle East and everything, I really wanted to do European transport. So I graduated. Part of that year I had a year out in the industry, which I went to work for a parcels distribution company in Glasgow. They went up halfway through my year. I ended up working at Currys of Dumfries, a well-known haulage company. And so I spent 8 months working with them on their European traffic desk. And to be honest with you, it wasn't the job to make, you know, that I think the degree really wanted, but it was experience and it was helpful. And I did learn a lot. I really did.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I did that. That was 94, and summer of 94 I went back to Huddersfield to finish the last year of my degree and graduated in 95. And my plan then was to get a job. I wanted to stay up north. I was really enjoying my time in Huddersfield. I liked the town. I foolishly started supporting the football team. And, you know, I had a lot of good friends up there now. My girlfriend was there at the time. And so I was looking for sort of northern jobs, ideally Leeds, Bradford, Huddersfield, Wakefield, that sort of thing. And this was a bit where I was a little bit naive. I was offered a job because the university does help, you know, they go out to employers and say, we've got this batch of fresh meat for you if you want to take any of them on. And this company, Skelmersdale, approached me. Alan Munro Transport. So I went and interviewed and everything, and they offered me a job. And it wasn't ideal. The location wasn't ideal, and where I really struggled was finding accommodation. So Wigan, unlike Huddersfield, because Wigan's not a university town, it didn't have a lot of sort of accommodation. I was looking for a bedsit or a shared house or something, and it just wasn't. And I did find this bedsit, but it was absolutely awful. It was really pokey, but it had no central heating, and it was really grim. But you know, I thought, well, it's a start, and you know. And unfortunately, I joined in sort of November, and it was absolutely freezing. And I went to work at this company, and quite frankly, they were shocking. They'd just been raided by the transport police after an investigation in the Observer newspaper showing they were running dodgy. So and this is how bad they were. They said, right, your first job is you've got to sort out the tachographs. And he said, sort them out by vehicle. I said, no, you need to sort them out by drivers. The drivers are the ones who are restricted by the hours. The trucks aren't. And he goes, oh, right. And he literally just gave me this box of tachographs. You know, a lot of them were damaged because obviously they're easy to damage. You know, so I'm doing this pretty mind-numbingly dull job to start with. You know, then my next job was I had to sort out the driver's expenses, which didn't make me very popular because most of them were on the fiddle because, you know, the receipts were either non-existent or quite clearly not genuine, you know, so we had to get the expenses under control, which I did do, and, you know, but when it came to a head for me personally was I was, every time I came up with an idea, I was always told, we've always done it this way, we'll stick with what we know.
Right.
And I sit and I think, well, you know, in the interview they said they wanted me to come in with ideas as a graduate and everything, and they just wouldn't, you know, my direct line manager, the transport manager, just wouldn't implement them. And then it really came to a head when IBM were a big customer of theirs, and that's who my dad worked for. And I remember listening to my boss on the phone to say, yeah, that'll be in Milan tomorrow. And I was and he put the phone down and I said, how's that going to be in Milan tomorrow? It's sat in our yard. And he said, oh, well, we'll double man it and then we'll just ring him tomorrow and say they broke down, so he's going to be a day late. And I just thought, is that the way you run? You book your customers, you know, you've got no regard for them. And the reason that trailer's in our yard and not in Milan is because you haven't planned properly, you know. But anyway, in March 96, I'd had enough. They'd had enough with me as well, I think. It wasn't working. So we just parted company, you know, and they didn't sack me. I didn't resign. We just sort of said, not pursued after a trial period or something, and off I went. The good thing with that is I could sign on straight away. So I came home. I'd actually, about a month before, actually had so much hassle with the bedsit, I'd moved back out, and I'd actually gone back to my parents, who were an hour away from Skelmersdale, but the money I was saving on the rent, I was spending on the fuel to go, but, you know, an hour commute from Greenfield to Skelmersdale every day was pretty horrific. So anyway, I basically had a day off and then thought, right, better get back on the horse. I started basically just, we didn't have email then, cold calling companies and writing to them saying, look, I'm a graduate, you know, and I decided I wasn't just going to take any job. I was going to get a job where I wanted to be. So I was applying in, as I say, in West Yorkshire mainly. And then the quirky bit came. The week that I left Alan Munro Transport on the Monday, on the Wednesday, as you may know, I've got an interest in railways. I've had an interest in railways since I was a kid. And there's a magazine I used to read called Rail, and they were advertised for a news and features writer. And I thought, well, hang on, I'm unemployed. I'd done some writing. I'd done the odd railway article, but I'd done writing at the university. I'd done the football reports and gig reviews and things. And so whereas I wasn't a trained journalist, I'd written a bit, you know, so I thought, well, I'll go for it. What's the worst that can happen, you know?
You've got nothing to lose, have you?
And I hadn't heard anything. And 4 weeks later, the magazine was fortnightly and it came out. 4 weeks later, the issue came out and said, oh, we've just appointed this guy. I thought, oh, bugger, well, the job's gone then. Anyway, I did know a guy who worked on it and I just rang him up and said, oh, I see they've appointed that. He said, well, actually, I'm leaving as well. So there's another job.
Okay.
I came home one day and my dad said, oh, Kath rang for you. I thought, I don't know anybody called Kath. And I'm going through my diary, Katie and whatever, you know, I messaged one or two young ladies and they hadn't rung me. And I didn't know who this Kath was. So, you know, there's nothing I could do, you know. And anyway, so she rang back about 3 weeks later and my dad said, oh, he doesn't know anybody called Kath. And she goes, oh, my, I'm ever so sorry, I didn't tell you who I was. You know, I'm the receptionist on Rail, would like to come for an interview. So it all moved very quickly there. They rang me on the Thursday. I rang them back straight away. Say, yeah, I can come for an interview. When do you want me? And they said, what about Monday? So, yep. So I drove off to Nottingham on the Sunday, stayed at my mate's house, drove over to Peterborough early on the Monday morning, very early. I was there like about 3 hours before I needed to be. I was, and had this interview, yeah. And it lasted 2.5 hours, you know, which was good because it wasn't you know, I was obviously making an impression, and they wanted to find out more. So I assumed, you know, anyway. So they said to me at the end of it, said, look, how would you fancy doing 4 weeks trial on a freelance contract? And then if we like you and you like us, we'll give you a permanent job. So I said, yes, yes, because I hadn't got anything else going on. And so they said, could you start on, well, it was a bank holiday week. And they said, could you start on the Tuesday? I said, I've got nowhere to live down there. And that was part of the problem I had with my previous. I said, don't worry, we've got that sorted. So this guy, she said, somebody will ring you about a room they've got in their house. So this guy rang me up. And it seemed all right. So, yeah. So I drove down on the Sunday. No, it wasn't a bank holiday Monday. I'm lying because I definitely drove down on the Sunday. Drove down on a Sunday, turned up at this guy's house. And he was really nice. And pretty much the first thing he said once I'd sort of unpacked my car was, should we go to the pub? And we did.
Always a good start.
and I've known him for 30 years. And So I got this job on rail in the 4 week. Well, after 3 weeks, they said, look, you know, do you want the job? I said, yeah. And I never looked back. And then that was 96, obviously 30 years ago. And so I enjoyed that, and I got some good training there. It was with EMAP, who were a big company.
So I guess at this point, sort of trucks had sort of faded from the forefront of your mind because you've got this new job to concentrate on.
I was still reading Truck every month. I was reading Truck and Driver, which was obviously had been going then as well. And I was still really interested in it, but I was quite happy doing the railways. But
yeah,
a little quirk of fate came in 2000 when Truck advertised that they wanted a writer.
Okay.
And I applied for it and I got it. But then when I went to hand my notice in at Rail, they made me a better offer, and I'd bought my house by this point. I didn't really want to move to Sutton, which was what was going to happen to work on Truck. And so when I worked it all out, you know, I got a decent pay rise, and I didn't have to move, and so I stayed, and that kind of I think that upset Andy Salter a little bit. Because I did send an apologetic email and said, look, I'd be happy to do some freelance for you. And he never even replied. But so I carried on. But after a while, I got headhunted for another railway magazine, which was a promotion in terms of I was going to be editor of it. And it was a magazine slightly more catered to my taste. So so I took that. And that was on a freelance basis. And when I went... because that was on a freelance basis, I was free to work for anybody, except I had a gentleman's agreement of not working for other railway magazines, obviously.
Yeah.
But trucks were fine. I'd already actually done a first job for trucking when Steve Hayes was editing it. I think I'd done that while I was actually still at Rail, I forget. I did it on a company local to me who ran a lot of Foden's at the time. But anyway, so I thought to myself, I wonder if I could get any truck work, you know, because I just enjoy doing it. I say I did the odd bit for trucking, but not a great deal. And then I thought I'd try Truck and Driver, you know, even though they're still part of the same empire as Truck, which had now closed, obviously, by then. That closed in 2004. And I didn't get anywhere, you know, and then... Funnily enough, I started sending them pictures to their picture post selection.
Yeah.
And none of them were getting published. And it confused me because some of the pictures I was sending were very interesting, and you know, they were a rare truck in the UK or something. Or they were just a nice picture, and without being arrogant, they were better than some of the pictures that were being published. I thought, you know.
Yeah, I get you.
And I just thought, you know, maybe I've been blacklisted. And then suddenly, the editor was Dave Young at that time. I think he was off ill for 3 or 4 months. And the production editor, deputy editor, Chris Turner, was running the show. And he obviously just found my pictures and just printed them. Thought, right, okay.
Right.
And then Dave came back and then nothing. And then I kept sending pictures in, nothing getting published. And then I sent one in under a fake name, the highly imaginative John Smith. And it not only got published, it was Picture of the Month. I thought, so there's definitely nothing wrong with the actual images I'm sending. It's purely...
the name.
yeah. And then I didn't think much of it. And then Dave Young left and Will Shires took over.
Yeah.
And Will did some brilliant features in Truck and Driver. And he did this feature where he got other people to drive a truck. A train driver, a caravan driver, a school bus driver, I think a school run mum or something. He got these five people, I think a pilot might have been one of them, to drive a truck, obviously on a private airfield or something.
Yeah.
And the train driver was a friend of mine. And I sent him a message, how the hell did you get this? He said, oh, I've known Will for ages, blah, 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 right. I said to him, look, can you have a word with him and ask if I'm blacklisted? You know, and I told him the story. And he came, he said, oh, I've spoken to Will. He said, he says you're not blacklisted. He says he's never heard of you. He said, but he did say he'd like to have a chat with you. So he gave me his number and I rang Will and we had this chat. And Will said, right, how do you fancy writing me 21 years of the Magnum, running a Magnum, which, so this was 2010, I think it was. So I wrote him that article as he requested, and it got published. It was my first interaction with the truck industry as such, because I had to ring the PR girl from Renault, Penny Brooks, who's still a good friend of mine today. And then he started offering me, you know, do you want to do this? And then I started pitching features to him, and he'd say, oh, yeah, I really like that. And then he rang me and says, I've got some bad news and good news. I said, go on. He said, I'm leaving Truck and Driver. I thought, oh, bloody hell. I've just got my foot in the door and you go. And he says, but the good news is Colin, who's taken over, wants to use your stuff. And I'm going to Commercial Motor, so I'll be needing some stuff there. So, right. And he immediately gave me two commissions for Commercial Motor. And then I spoke to Colin, and Colin, bless him, lovely guy, bit disorganised. I don't think he'll mind me saying that, but I'd send him something and I'd never hear anything. And then he'd suddenly email me and say, oh yes, can you, I have that article. All right. Okay. So I did him, you know, I did an article about naming trucks, you know, like after our Knights of old used to name them after knights, and Stobarts obviously named them after to women and all that sort of thing. So I did an article on that. And then I did an article about a really kind of weird juxtaposition. When steam trains run on the national network, they need water, which can only come by lorries because there's no water facilities like there used to be. So right. Road tankers take the water to them. And in 2009, a brand new steam loco was built, a thing called Tornado. Massive,
really?
Great big thing. Yeah, brand new. To the old design, it was exactly to the old design. And that had been built and was running on the main line, and the guys who managed it were very PR savvy, and you used to get press releases all the time. But one of them knew I liked my trucks. He said, oh, I photographed the truck which delivered our water at the weekend, is it of any interest? And it was a T-cab Scania. I said, bloody hell, okay. Yeah. And he said, oh right, I'll give you the guy's number. And he gave me the guy's number, Buxton Tankers. I rang them up. Yeah, I would happily love to do an article. So I got train up to Wakefield where the truck was, met the driver. We went, got the truck, drove to Newcastle, Tyne Yard in Newcastle, to fill this steam engine up with water in this T-cab Scania. The headline was T for Tornado, which I thought was quite a good headline. And that was a really good feature. And then I'd been on holiday and I'd stumbled across a working Bedford TL coal lorry down there, and I did an article on that. I even had a driver that. And then me and Will did this article. We raced a truck and a train, and Will went up on the train, on the freight train, and I went up in the truck, which was a Mercedes Actros. This was 2010, so it was a version 3 Actros, top of the range. And we raced it. So basically, the minute the signal went green at the yard in Daventry for the train to go, we set off in the truck. And it was really good. It was a bit Top Gear-ish, you know. And it was really funny as we got on. We went obviously on to M1. And then as we went on the M6, we went over the West Coast Main Line just as the freight train went under, which was brilliant. Would have been fantastic with a drone, but obviously we didn't have that then. And we had a really good run in the truck, and we managed to get to Gretna before we had to take our 45. And because the train runs to a schedule, unlike a lorry, we knew where the train was going to be, and Will could message us. And the train started running early because it had lots of these little stops where it's meant to wait for other trains to overtake it, but they were late, so they just let it run. So suddenly it's an hour and a half early. So when we pulled into the freight terminal at Coatbridge in near Glasgow, we generally didn't know whether we'd beaten it. We beat it only by 20 minutes, but it was a great article. But during that feature, Will said to me, have you got your HGV? I said, well, funnily enough, I've only got provisional, because if rewinding back to that brief stint I had at Curry's, when I was at Curry's, I asked if I could get L plates and learn to drive, and they miraculously said yes. So I used to do driving after work. I used to go from Dumfries to Glasgow or Ayr or somewhere and back. But I never got to do my test. And then when I was at Alan Munro, again, I had a couple of trips out in a FL10, but I never got around to doing my test before I went back to uni, and I never had the money to do it. And then now I was self-employed, I had the money, and I checked with my accountant and said, can I put this through the company? He said, yes, it's legitimate training, which it quite clearly has proved to be.
Yeah.
And I did my test, and luckily, because I had to do ridges and arctics, as was the law then, I passed them both first time. So 2012, I got my Arctic test, January 2012. And whereas it wasn't suddenly Will giving me loads more jobs because I'd now got a license, what happened in 2015 is he approached me to take on Truck and Driver. He said that the technical editor of Commercial Motor, I think it was David Wilcox was his name, was leaving. He was retiring. And Colin, who was editing Truck and Driver, was going to take that on. So there was a vacancy on Truck and Driver. And I was the perfect fit. So I was also coming up to the renewal on my freelance contract on the Rail magazine I was doing at the time, and I knew they were going to cut the money down, and we'd been taken over by this new company and this, that and the other. So I just thought, well, my contract is literally going to finish at the time they want me to start Truck and Driver. So I thought, well,
that's perfect timing.
Yeah, you know, clean break and a change. And I'd always wanted to do Truck and Driver. I love Truck and Driver as a magazine. I'm gutted it's been closed down recently.
Yeah, you're not the only one.
and so I took it. And the first year was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And then it kind of went a little bit sour in the second year for reasons I won't say on air. Mm-hmm. And we parted company. I was about a couple of months shy of 2 years doing it. And we parted company. And I went back to being purely freelance. And luckily, the wonders of Facebook, I just happened to mention this on Facebook. And a friend of mine, who was a magazine editor of a classic magazine, mentioned it to his boss, because he was looking for somebody to edit Truck Stop News, the free newspaper that came out every fortnight. So
yep.
I took that on, which was great because it kept me in the industry. It was pretty much seamless from Truck and Driver. There was only a couple of months break in them. And during that period, I also got offered to take on Classic Truck, which Steve Hayes had launched for KLC.
Yeah.
And that was right up my street, because that was all the kit I grew up with in those days in the 70s and 80s, you know, Scania 112s and all the trucks I remember being launched in the early 80s, you know, the Scania GPR series, the DAF 95, all these things which I can remember reading about in Truck Magazine were now the restoration projects and for my generation. So I loved that magazine. I really enjoyed it. I got some really good feedback. Apparently I got an uplift in sales in the first couple of issues, you know, so I must have been doing something right. And I really, really enjoyed it.
This episode of Matt's Truck and Grep podcast is proudly sponsored by Creasy Drainage. If you're dealing with blocked drains, flooding or drainage problems, Creasy Drainage is a team to call. They provide professional drainage services for homes and businesses, including drain unblocking, repairs, septic tank emptying and CCTV drainage surveys. They're known for fast response times, honest advice and getting the job done right the first time. For reliable drainage services you can trust, check out Creasy Drainage. The details will be in the show notes.
And then the pandemic came. And then in the pandemic, I got a phone call to say, we're closing Classic Truck and Truck Stop News is going to 4 weekly rather than 2 weekly. And you suddenly think, oh my God, what's going to happen here? That's the biggest part of my work, you know. So luckily, mm-hmm. I'd been doing some freelance for some other rail magazines as well. And I just did what I could. And I had a book project which I was writing. I was writing a railway book which I was going to self-publish, and I thought the book had essentially been written, but it kind of got held up because I hadn't taken the plunge and there were a few things I needed to clear up on it. So I just decided I'm going to finish that book. So all the things which were holding it up, which were basically queries, I decided I'm either going to find out the answer, rewrite it, or take it out or whatever, which is what I did. And so I published this book and it was a big success, thank God. And then I started getting some bookazine work. I did a series on railways and then I did a series on trucks. I did the Classic Trucks of the UK series. And then, funnily enough, during all that, trucking came up, but I didn't apply for the trucking job because I had too much work on at that time. If trucking had been 5-6 months later, it would have been perfect, because having let the trucking job not apply for it, let it go essentially, although I was still writing for them at that point and still am today, the bookazines got kiboshed. I just started a new series. We did one and they said, oh, we're just pausing this. So that, you know, suddenly, and I was doing stuff. I started doing a bit more for commercial motor as well, and even the odd thing for truck and driver again, and a few other bits and pieces here. But it was at the end of 2024, I was actually I suddenly realized I was struggling a bit here. I hadn't got enough income coming in. And luckily, then my friend said, who was editing Railways Illustrated, which is a magazine I'd edited from 06 to 2015, he said he was leaving. So I applied to get my old job back, and luckily I did. But again, it's on a freelance basis. So I do regular stuff for trucking. I tend to do then one or two features a month, a test drive and an operator profile. I do bits for commercial motor. I was doing bits for truck and driver, obviously not now. I do stuff for Heritage Commercials, and well, that's now been rebranded Classic Truck, and
which is also now finishing as well.
Yeah, which is also now finishing. I didn't say that because I wasn't sure whether it was public knowledge, but obviously it is. And Heritage Commercials, Classic Vintage Commercials, I'm doing a bit for them, and I think hopefully I'll be able to fill the void of Classic Truck by doing something a bit more for them. There is bizarrely talk of bookazines coming back as well. So suddenly I'm in this really, because when you're freelance, you kind of don't turn work down unless you can't do it. And that means you can't do it because you haven't got the time, or you can't do it because you haven't got the subject knowledge. So a commercial motor came on to me and said, oh, could I write about early electric trucks of the 1930s, and probably not. I'll leave that to somebody a bit more experienced. But if they ask me to do something about the Scania 113 range or something, then yep, I can do that straight for you. When do you want it? That sort of thing. So luckily I've got a good client base and I've got good contacts in the publishing industry and the truck industry. And on top of all that, I've got my HGV license, so I still do a bit of casual driving. I was actually out the last weekend, which is the first casual drive I've done this year. I did it.
Wow.
I did a bit over Christmas. It tends to pick up in the summer when drivers want holidays and what have you, and they need a bit of cover. Yeah. And I like that because it keeps my hand in. It gives me, it shows me the industry in the real light, so I can write about it a bit more authoritatively. So, you know, I have an opinion piece in Trucking every month, and that's about the industry. And I feel I can get a little bit more respect from drivers and operators if I'm talking about real life situations.
If you're actually driving the things.
Yeah, and you know, and I do get those real life situations. I do get RDCs which are badly managed and RDCs which are very well managed. I do, you know, there's certain things in the industry I don't like. I've actually just written a piece, actually. I was actually driving my car at this point, but I drove home the other week and I saw one of the, what I deemed a really irresponsible driving by an Arctic driver. Really bad driving. And I've written a piece about that because, you know, you can't lose sight that whereas this industry is 99.9% angels, there are some people who think that they can drive like a lunatic and not drive with due care and attention and other road users in an articulated lorry, which is wrong.
Yes, and, definitely.
You know, and I will fight the corner truckers with my last breath, but I also won't tolerate idiots. You know, I mean, I never understood drivers who, I don't put my seatbelt on. And I just sit there and think, why? And, you know, drivers, you know, it's less so now, but the drivers who used to fiddle their tacos, and you sit there and think, why would you do that? Because driving for 9 hours a day, just physical drive, not mentioning all the other stuff you do in a day, which makes it a 12, 13 hour day, is absolutely draining. Why on earth would you want to keep going and put another card in? I just don't get it. I mean, I always stick to my brakes. I had one instance a while back where, because of roadworks, I was running late and I was going to miss getting to my RDC in my 4.5 by about 7 minutes. And, you know, I said, oh, do I just crack on and print out saying nowhere safe to stop or something? And I thought, well, that's a lie, because there are safe places. So I pulled up in a residential area, because on this diversion around Bolton, and I could see there was room for me to park my lorry up, and I parked up and had the 45 minutes I needed legally. And, you know, I think that if I'm writing and preaching to a degree to other drivers about being, having pride in the industry and doing it properly, I can't then flout the rules just to suit me, you know.
Well, you've got to practice what you preach.
Exactly.
Then.
I mean, I had one day, I had one of those days, and every driver's had them, where everything went wrong, you know. The job that I was planned to do the night before, when I got into the office, I just needed to detour to pick up this pallet at such and such, which meant a detour and then a wait, and it put 2 hours on the day. And then being 2 hours later, I then got caught up in a major carnage on the M62, where I sat there for another hour or so. And then, oh, all sorts of things. It just, you know, even
one of them days.
Yeah, and oh, that was it. When I'm coming home, you know, the M62's closed in the other direction, so I end up having to go over Woodhead, which I don't mind, except over the Woodhead Pass in the dark. And I'm really, it's been a really long day. I've still got plenty of driving time because I've been sat around a lot. But by the time I got into the yard, I'd done a 14-hour day. And you sit there and think, wow, you know, and mm-hmm. I can earn more writing an article in a fraction of that time. But from the experience point of view, and the, as I say, the experience to write about it, that actually is kind of priceless, you know.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. And I'm paranoid about low bridges, because I've written several pieces over the years saying there's very little excuse for hitting a low bridge. So the minute I get diverted, I pull over and check that I'm not going to go anywhere where I'm not necessarily going to hit a bridge, but I'm going to, might get into a situation where I have to turn around. And it's not easy, you know. Funnily enough, I had this on a Mercedes test drive about 2 or 3 years back. There was no advance warnings to say, if you go down this road, there's a low bridge. You just keep going down, and then you get the signs, it's a low bridge. Now, luckily, it wasn't that low, and we could get under it. But I sat there and thought, if I'd had a double-deck trailer on, or car transporter or something, I would have had to turn around. And it was in a residential area. I think it was in Mossley, near Oldham. And, you know, and I wrote a piece saying, you know, signage about low bridges needs to be earlier than that, you know, because you're at the point of not necessarily no return, but you're at the point of inconvenience, I should say. Whereas if I'd have seen at the junction low bridge ahead, well, I would have said, okay, right, I'm okay to go. But if I'd been driving that double deck trailer or something, I would have think, I can't go down there. What do I do? Well, I carry on down here and I'll pull over and find out, you know. I mean, luckily we have all, you know, smartphones and everything. You can get all the information pretty much straight there. But that wasn't the case back in the day. But
no, you said the old trucker's atlas with the bridge heights marked on it.
But you know, and they're only as good as the people who update them. But mm-hmm. you know, I love driving lorries. I've always said that if I needed to, that would be my job. If you know, if the writing dried up to the point I wasn't making a living, you know, I would
get
behind the wheel. And I might not do full time, and I probably wouldn't do tramping or something, but I might do enough. But because I hadn't driven since Christmas, apart from I did 3 or 4 test drives, but even those were actually in the last month, to get out on the road on a commercial job, being a truck driver, behaving like a truck driver, and appreciating truck driving was really enjoyable. And I had a nice little truck. So, you know, and you know, I'm very lucky, because a little bit less so at the moment, but certainly when I was doing Truck and Driver and Truck Stop News and that sort of thing, I was going to a lot of press events. I was driving brand new launch trucks. So, you know, I drove the very first Scania new gen for a magazine, which was bizarrely a day before the press launch. I've driven the new updated DAFs, which were launched about 18 months ago. I drove them on their first event in Spain. My favourite drive ever was the Scania Winter Drive up in Trissel in Norway, where you're driving 70-ton timber trucks, you know,
in the snow and ice,
uphill, fully loaded, a 6x2 rigid with a dolly and a full 40-foot behind it. And then it was a heavy haulage truck. It must have been 60 or 70 tons. It had a massive, great big digger on it, but that was oversized because the digger's tracks were over the width of the truck, and you're going downhill on a snowy road as other trucks are coming up. And it's a bit of a eye-opener, and it's a bit of a white knuckle. But when I took on Truck and Driver, I said I wasn't going to shirk any driving. So, yeah. I mean, we never got to that stage. But if they'd have said to me, right, we're going to send you out to do what those ice road truckers did in Colombia or somewhere in South America, that really ridge road, I'd have had a go. I'd have probably been cacking myself, as they say politely, but I'd have had a go. I never shirked anything. And even that, bizarrely, when I did start my casual truck driving, we used to joke in the transport press, you know, we're good at driving them forwards, but we can't drive them backwards because you never really have to reverse them. And you certainly don't reverse onto loading bays on a test run or a ride and drive event. But so when I first started my casual driving, I was pretty bad at reversing, but you soon get the knack. The problem is, for me, I was driving one Sunday and then maybe the next Sunday or maybe 3 weeks or something, so there wasn't that ability to get the continuity. If I was reversing day in, day out, I'd have cracked it within 2 weeks, but I now have cracked it, thank God. And I don't, you know, I don't shirk about it. I get annoyed when I get given the tightest bay possible, but that's just the job. And, you know,
I think every driver is the same with that.
I remember on one of my very first days out on my own, I was delivering a place called G's at Barway, and they line you up and then they tell you your bay and you go on, and I'm going on this bay and I'm making an absolute hash of it, and I can see the drivers behind me tutting and everything. Anyway, I got the bloody thing on the bay, and then I just went up to the guy who was right behind me and I just said, look, I'm sorry, mate, it's my first day on the job. It was actually my second, but I fibbed. I said, it's my first day on the job. And you could see his face change from this angry, say, what are you doing, to, no problem, mate, we've all been there, which we have all been there, you know. Yes. And I'm that now, so I'm not sitting there cursing any driver because they can't get onto a bay. I'm just sitting there thinking, take your time to. And I remember from my HGV test, and excuse the language, but this was the quote, the bloke used to say, don't be a take a shunt, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And it was funny because when I did my Arctics test, I did exactly that. I took an eternity to do the reversing manoeuvre, but I knew I'd passed it because I hadn't gone over the yellow lines and I hadn't clipped anything. And it might have been slow and sedate, but it was safe. But then when we went out on to do the road test, I was convinced I'd clipped a curb or something when I'd left the test centre. So I thought, oh my God, I failed it. So I just sort of sat back and I said to myself, I might as well enjoy this drive. It might be my last one for a while.
Yeah.
And they hadn't told me whether to use cruise control or anything. So I'm going down the A1 and I slip my cruise control on. And anyway, I get back to the test centre. He said, oh, I'm pleased to say you've passed. And I was really pleased to see you using your cruise control. I thought, right, okay. And that was the minute he said, oh, well, you've passed. This was my Arctic. So that was such a weight off my mind, because all I was thinking about that is that if I failed it, is I was going to have to find the expense to do it again, which obviously it was academic then. And I still maintain, I mean, it cost me $2,500 to do the two tests, the rigid and Arctic, but I maintain it's probably the best $2,500 I've spent, because
I'd say so,
because of the opportunities that it's opened up. You know, I mean, Will said it wasn't a clincher for me, him approaching me for Truck and Driver, me having a license, said, but it's a bloody big help, you know. Yeah. So it was definitely, you know. And I say, I do enjoy driving lorries. I don't want to do it every day, particularly mainly because I enjoy writing, you know. And, you know, I work from home, which is very nice, so, and very helpful. Yeah. But I do love getting out on the road, driving. And if somebody said to me, do you want to take a Volvo F12 to the to Qatar, I probably would.
Yeah, I'd rather, well, why not?
I'd probably rather go in an FH500 Aero than an F12, if I'm perfectly honest. But and that's another thing. I have driven a Volvo F12, which was my dream truck, you know, and Martin Tomlinson, who's a good friend at Volvo, he set up that for me back in my truck and driver days, and I was like the cat who got the cream. I had finally driven an F12, which was the truck I really loved as a kid, you know. And I've driven a Guy Big J4T, which was, well, I mean, it just gave you total respect for the guys who drove guys and Atkinsons and ERFA series and all these 180 Gardeners with not enough power and a horrible gearbox and no power steering and no night heater and no sleeping, you know. It gives you such respect. I know a lot of these old timers still hanker for those days, but I think deep down they would rather drive a DAF XG than an Atkinson Border, and anybody who says differently is probably lying.
Yeah, with a nice auto box.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and that's, you know, auto boxes, I love them. People, you know, they behave like manuals are badge of honor, and you know, I've got manual license, I've driven manual lorries, I don't mind driving manual lorries, but I prefer an automatic, you know. Same with the digital mirrors, people don't like them. I understand why they don't like them, they're not perfect, I like them. But even, you know, I do find there's the odd little glitch with them. Not glitched, but there's an odd, you know, you can't necessarily see if somebody's flashed you in or something. But you know you're safe to flash in because of the lines, but you don't want to appear rude or ignorant by not flashing, or appear sarcastic or something by doing your indicators when the guy's saying, well, I didn't flash you in. But I think, you know, I look at modern lorries now and they're just amazing, you know. I did a sleeper test on an XG Plus the other week, you know, and I don't sleep very well in unfamiliar surroundings, but I slept really well in that, you know.
Yeah.
I still think truck cabs could be even better, but I think they need legislation changes before they do. But, you know, I understand why we've got the XG and the XG Plus and we've got the XXL FH and the bigger cabs, because the, you know, just the wider bunk is a godsend for drivers.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I still get a real kick out of going to see a new truck for the first time, or maybe even just seeing the first one on the road for the first time, you know. It's just I love the progression. And it's funny, coming back to the railways, you know, new things on the railways, the people don't like them. They love the old kit.
Yeah,
and everything. But
this is sounding familiar.
Yeah, but on the trucks, you know, I love an F12, but if it was my day-to-day job, I'd have an Aero any day of the week over an F12. Yeah. And, you know, I remember driving a Actros version 1 with that EPS gearbox.
Yeah.
And it was, I got the knack of it just about. I didn't like it at all. I did say if I was driving it every day, you'd get used to it, and it might, once you got used to it, you might suddenly think, actually, this is, you know, it's a bit like when you listen to an album for the first time, you can't really appreciate it till about the 10th listen. So with any new truck, you know, it does take, you know, and that's, you know, I like to do road tests with trucks in real working conditions. You know, the road tests I do with press vehicles are, you know, they're not always loaded, to be honest with you, and some, you know, always press trucks always have all the bells and whistles and they're top of the range of spec, even if it's a fleet spec XD DAF XD, it will have, you know, the leather steering wheel and all this sort of stuff, it will be all options ticked, whereas the trucks you drive in real life won't be. But I was thinking about this when I drove this DAF XD on Saturday. Even then, though, a basic fleet spec truck now has got so much going for it. It's got electric windows, it's got cruise control, it's got DAB radio, it's got plug sockets, it's got, you know, air conditioning, you know, all these sort of things, which some trucks we only got if you tick the box on them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think there's an option for aircon now. It's just standard on a truck, you know. Same with cruise control. It's standard. But,
yeah,
you know, the options now are, do you want digital mirrors or not? And I think that will soon slowly change to, well, if you want conventional mirrors, it's a special build. It's going to cost you $2,000 more. And they'll just say, no, I'll stick with the digital mirrors, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think anybody builds a manual now.
No.
I think Iveco they say they do, but I don't know of anybody who's ordered one. Scania dropped it with the Super Range, so they were pretty much the last. Volvo hasn't had manuals for years. DAF dropped it with their new generation range. In fact, a few people were snapping up XFs and CFs with manual gearboxes on 72 and 73 plates because they were the last manuals they could get.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I've been doing writing about lorries now for nearly 15 years professionally. Been writing full stop for 30 years, which is makes me feel bloody old. But for a career I didn't intend to go into, I really enjoyed it.
You haven't done too bad.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I've also done, which I'm going to do a bit of a plug here, I've also published a book on the Middle East. I didn't write it. A guy who most listeners will probably know, Ivor Whittle, he'd written his first book on the Silk Road runs, which was published a few years ago by Old Pond. And Old Pond and Ninehead, which were the two sort of big truck publishers in the UK, both have stopped. Old Pond's, I believe, got sold out to a company who stopped the truck side of it, and Ninehead just retired. And so Ivor had written his second volume of memoirs and needed a publisher. So I had a chat through Paul Rowland, who you must know because he's over your way. And he said, would I publish it? And I said, yeah. And then he said, look, the problem is there's no real pictures because he used all his pictures in the first book. And I said, well, in that case, let's just do a paperback novel, you know. And so he sent me through the manuscript. And I've read all the Middle East books, the George Bennett books, the Ashley Coghill books, the Paul Rowland's books. And I've loved them. And they always make you think, oh, I wish I'd done that. That must have been fun. And then I read Ivor's first book. In fact, I actually sub-edited it for Old Pond. And then I was reading the manuscript for the second book. And this was the first one where I thought, God, I'm glad I didn't do that because of the challenges he had, you know. And there's this bit where he's been out to the Middle East, either Iran or Iraq, I forget which one. And then he's coming back home and they turned him around at Turkey, said, we need you to go up to Yugoslavia, pick up this trailer, take it down to Saudi, and then come. And he said, I'm not having that, you know, I've been out for 4 weeks, you know. And they eventually persuaded him with a healthy bonus, and deep down you knew he was going to do it because, you know, you put the job first. So he doesn't get home. He gets halfway back and then turns around and goes back to the Middle East. And he's been out like 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks or something. And everything, finally gets home. And then he has a week off and goes back out. And they sent me the manuscript and it just finished midway. And I said, hang on, what's going on? And then Paul said, oh, hang on. And he hadn't sent me the full thing. So a few days later, he sent me the rest of it and I read it. And it was just, you know, and I could actually picture him. There's this bit where he said he had to strip down a tilt in 45 degree heat, you know, and the metal poles on the tilt were so hot you couldn't hold them, you had to have gloves on, you know. And I can actually picture him when he said, and luckily there's a vending machine which had ice cold Cokes. He seemed to live on ice cold Cokes and everything, and it was just such a great story. And if anybody wants to buy one, they can. If you want to head to www.eastfieldmedia.com, you can buy a copy there. I hope you don't mind me plugging this book. I've got a few to ship.
Not at all.
I could do with shifting the last ones. But yes, so that is a really, really good read. I mean, I've had nothing but positive feedback. I've had people saying, oh, I got it. I couldn't put it down. I read it in a day, you know. You know, somebody said, oh, God, the missus is pissed off with me because we went on holiday and first day one, I pulled out this book thinking I'll have a read of a chapter and I just couldn't put it down. And it was, it is a very, very infectious read. It's brilliant. It's well written and it's just really, really sums up what that era was. And, you know, I look at all the Facebook groups for the Middle East drivers and everything and the great photos that they put on there. And you see the trucks that they were driving. I mean, there were some who went out in day cabs, but even the guy who went out in Mercedes M cab sleepers, those really pokey sleepers, and the DAF 2600 with a really tiny bunk and what have you.
It was a whole other world, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I always say this though, but at the time, that DAF 26 was probably the best truck on the road. You know, that and the Scania 110 or the 140 if you wanted the VA or the F88. You get into an F88 now and it looks so pokey and tiny, and there's a massive engine hump, and the bunk and the mattresses are like, you know, you probably get
wafer thin.
Yeah, you probably get a better one on death row. You know, it's just
so that's how it was.
You know, and briefly, sort of into, I remember I say when I was at Alan Munro with these drivers, we had a job, and the only thing we had to take this trailer to Belgium was an FL10. And this guy said, "I'm not driving an FL10 on the continent. It's tiny." And we said, "You're only going to Belgium. I mean, it's no further than going to Cornwall, you know." Yeah. And he wouldn't have it. He was an agency driver, so we just rang the agency up, said, "Don't send this bloke again."
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
And, you know, yes, as an employer, you need to give your drivers a basic. You wouldn't ask somebody now to do a night out in a day cab.
No.
You know, you'd expect a sleeper. But, you know, and most drivers get a good truck to drive. But, you know, if your Scania S-Cab is off the road and there's a job that needs doing and it's a night out and the only thing you've got is a Scania P-Cab, but it is a sleeper, can you do it for one night? Any driver says, "Of course I can, boss. You know, we've got to get the job done." You know, if the guy's saying, "I'm selling your S-Series and you're having a P-Cab for forever now," then I understand some driver might say, "Well, I don't think that's big, you know, that's fair for me tramping." So, you know.
Yeah.
And then they might, you know, and it's not good for you because your driver will deem it to be a lack of respect and move on. And truck drivers seem to be back in demand again, I see, from the amount of job adverts I see on Facebook and other things saying we need a driver.
Yeah, certainly seems that way.
So, yeah, you know. You know, this industry, the guys are, I think, are all, they're all heroes, you know. I got really frustrated. I've been really frustrated for years. We talk about teachers and nurses and everything who do fantastic jobs, and I don't deny that, but so do truck drivers. We got a tiny little bit of recognition in the first week or two of the pandemic. We were knights of the road. We were key workers and heroes and everything, but that soon stopped. And,
oh, yes.
You know, and I see car drivers who just do not understand how lorry drivers need room on the road, how they need to, you know, they can't turn round, you know, if they've started their movement, they, even if you might have right of way by the point you see that truck, if he's already doing the manoeuvre, he's got to keep going. Why can't you just let drivers through, you know?
People are too impatient these
days.
Well,
they are, you know, and I see it, you know, I see it on the road. You know, they overtake you and then they leave at the last minute, cut straight across you and then down the slip road that they thought they could get past you, you know. Oh, you know, it drives me nuts, and I dare say it drives every driver nuts.
Definitely.
The lack of education. I mean, I always say, you know, I think when you pass your car test, you should go out in a lorry for a day, but I do appreciate that's wholly impractical. But, you know, and, you know, I've had to explain to my wife and now my daughter why truck drivers have to do certain things, you know, and most of it is pure physics. They have to swing out wide because otherwise the trailer's going to cut straight across a lamppost or something. Yeah. You know, they're not doing it for kicks and giggles. They're doing it because that's the way you got to do it, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And you know, I do think the horror stories that are at DC's kind of, well, they certainly outweigh the good stories, I think. But occasionally you do get a horror story at an RDC. You know, I had one, well, I don't know whether you call it a horror story, but I had one where I was sat in my cab waiting to be unloaded. The light was red. And it wasn't until this driver came out and said, "Oh, they want you inside, mate. You need to do something to your trailer." And what they'd done, I'd got a fridge on and I'd got two different temperatures, so I'd got the dividers in. So they'd unloaded the first bit and then they didn't tell me I needed to come and move these dividers. They didn't tell me that at the point when I gave my paperwork in or when they started unloading it or when they finished the first bit of unloading. They just sat there, and it wasn't thanks to this driver telling me that I went in, and that cost me half an hour just sitting around, you know, sitting around on my backside. I mean, I've got to admit, I'm quite lucky. When I go out to work, I always take some of my writing work, be it proofreading or my laptop or whatever, so I can always do something while I'm sat on a bay. I had it on Saturday, you know. I'd been asked to get there for 8 o'clock, so I get there for 8 o'clock. oh, you're not going to be loaded till 10 o'clock, driver. Oh, for Christ. I mean, yeah. This place was literally 2 minutes from home. You know, if they'd have told me, you know, it's going to be 10 o'clock, I could have had 2 hours extra at home, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I don't think it's, in this day and age with communication, if that company has booked a lorry for 8 o'clock and they know it's not going to be 10 till 10 o'clock, can't they ring the company and say, oh, just let you know, it's going to be 10 o'clock now. And they can ring me and say, oh, job's still on, but you don't need to be there till 10. Now, luckily, I had to ring a haulier. I needed some quotes for an article I was writing, so I rang him and got that out the way. And then I'd got some proofreading for a book that I had to do, so I got a lot of that done. So luckily, I didn't waste my time. And yeah, you know, I've got a bunk in the cab. I could have had a kip if I'd have wanted to. But it's not just the frustration. It's just the fact it was avoidable.
Yeah.
It was totally avoidable. And we live in this age now, you know, where everything, you know. I went to an RDC at Wakefield once. They had 34 bays there, but only 4 bays were being used. The rest of them were full of their trailers. So they had 4 bays that they'd allocated for goods inwards. 2 of them were knackered, and the other 2 had lorries on them. And there was 8 or 9 lorries. So I actually went in and said, look, can you move? Can you do something? We're all sitting here. If we have to go one in, one out for 9 lorries, we're going to be here for 4 or 5 hours. And to be fair to them, they got the guy out in his dock spotter, I call them. I don't know what you call them, tugs or whatever. And he cleared off 4 trailers and 4 trucks got straight on. And then it all eased. And then another RDC, a similar situation, where, and this was actually really impressive, and this was Aldi. So I've had my gripes with Aldi, but I'll give them credit for this one. They let us unload, even though we were now unloading in the bakery section and we were bringing chilled goods, and it meant they had to drag them through the warehouse a bit longer. So it took longer to unload, but they got us on bays earlier, you know.
Yeah.
But those RDCs, they need people in there, people like me with a transport logistics degree, to sit there and say, right, we've got all these loads coming in. Have we got the bays? Currently, we've got 4 bays, but I can see there's 12 trucks coming in, you know. Well, can we clear up at least 4 or 5 bays, because they were just trailers sitting there, you know.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if they're waiting to be loaded, get them loaded, and if the loads aren't ready, get them off the bays and let, you know, just good planning, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
And I still,
that's the world of transport.
Yeah, and that actually, coming back full circle to where we started, kind of reminds me why you do need graduates and logisticians, you know.
Yeah. So, oh, absolutely.
It was funny, actually, when I was studying my degree, one of my lecturers, I said, oh, I'm going to do my HGV test. She said, oh, don't you dare, she said, that was the worst thing you could do. I said, I don't believe I can manage lorry drivers. I can't do their job. She said, if you've got an HGV, you will just use that as an excuse to get, you know, not find a solution. Just, oh, well, that load needs moving. I've no driver, I'll do it. Whereas if you haven't got an HGV, you've got to solve that problem. And I thought, well, I don't actually quite understand your logic there, but,
no.
You know, but I think a transport manager would get a lot more respect if they've got a license. And I also, in hindsight, I always say I don't regret doing my degree 1 iota, and I did enjoy my university years. That certainly, I lived them to the full, shall we say.
Yep.
But I would have been a better transport manager if at age 18 I'd gone to a decent sized company which needed transport managers, said, I'm fresh out my A-levels, I want to become a transport manager, I've got a choice of going to university, or you can take me on and basically give me an apprenticeship. And I think I'd have got a better education as an apprentice transport manager, working day in, day out within the company and getting paid for it at the same time, and progressing up to become a transport manager.
Yeah, you know, I'd say so.
Because a lot of transport managers fall into it. They've done driving, and then they want to either move into the office because they don't want to carry on driving because of the family implications. And then, you know, and that's how they become. And some of them, most of them become very good transport managers. Some of them, not necessarily. Some of them still want to go out on the road and actually will make excuses to go and do a delivery, which probably isn't solving the problem. But there you go.
No, there we go. Right, Pip. Well, I've taken up more than enough of your time.
I was going to say, I've rattled on for an hour and a quarter now. I hope that's been interesting to you and your listeners.
Yeah, I think so.
Let's do it again sometime if I've got if I've got anything else left to talk about. I might have been all talked
out. Well, that's
out.
It. We shall catch up with you at the show, no doubt.
Well,
I'm
at Truckfest this Saturday, and then I shall be at Gaydon, no doubt in June. And Gaydon certainly at the Retro Truck Show, which is my favourite event of the year. I'll be at Kelsall this year, so I'll still be going.
Yep, fantastic. Well, lovely to speak to you, Pip.
No problem, Matt. Always good to chat.
We'll speak soon.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.